Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Can Opera turn over a new relevant leaf? Viewers of all art start learning tonight with the debut of Everything for Dawn, a groundbreaking serialized exercise. Aaron Siegel, the executive director of Experiments in Opera, joins me next, and we'll both be joined by Dawn herself, Britt Hewitt. Our second 30-minute deals with Time Lock, a new speculative novel and TV series possibility. We'll deal with co-author Peter Burke, the son of prolific 1970s episodic TV writer Howard Burke. Also ahead, Kropopolis still stands, our classic trivia question, and the alternate sports presentation movement. That's our takeaway of the week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. I present on Google Podcasts, the iRadio Podcast Network, Spotify, Acast, and other leading podcast platforms. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. We appreciate all of you joining us on this Friday afternoon, 73 degrees at the top of the hour, going up to 75 before the end of today. And you're right in time for the program all about TV's current and future. Have some wonderful guests coming away over the next 90 minutes, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and dial in. When you do, this is the number you use, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn Radio. We also have our chat room business for you, and you can find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Marshall 12 has just joined the room. So use the phone or the room. Either way, we get you interactive with our guests. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn screen. Follow the instructions of other people live with you. Our guests from the new all-art serialized opera, Everything for Dawn, will join me here in the Big Apple after these news notes. Bad news, great news for viewers anticipating Dan Harmon's next tune series set in ancient Greece, Percopolis. The premiere on Fox has been pushed to 2023 from late this year. That's the bad news. Now the great. Harmon's tune is the green light from Fox to go ahead and make a second season. Fox officials say they're fully behind the move based on the work accomplished so far. In other animated activity, Disney Channel used its space at New York's Comic-Con earlier this afternoon to announce KIFF, that's K-I-F-F, a new series involving producers of Adventure Time, Phineas and Ferb, and Captain Planet. KIFF centers on a buddy relationship between the title character, a squirrel voiced by Kimiko Glenn, and a bunny voiced by H. Michael Kroner. Each half-hour episode will include an original song. Now, quickies. Anne Rice's Mayfair Witches has a premiere date and location, January 5th, 2023, on AMC+. It will premiere there and be there exclusively. The first two episodes will play that evening. One more final season of His Dark Materials will start December 5th on HBO. Prime Video tune The Legend of Vox Machina will get a third season. Vox's sophomore run begins next January. Laurel Holly Quinn will come to HBO Max for Valentine's Day 2023. Titled this special, A Very Problematic Valentine's Day. Unscripted series Buying Beverly Hills moves in with Netflix Abode November 4th. 8 episodes will run. Breaking news, America's Got Talent will launch an all-star series on NBC next year. Production is already underway. And true crime satire Indefensible, hosted by Oscar nominee Jana Friedman, begins October 27th on Sundance TV, with some play also on AMC+. And that is news notes for today. Here's a fact that you may not believe. For a good time in the 20th century, the 1930s to the 50s on radio, and the first decade, full decade of television in the 1950s, one of the most popular attractions was opera. For decades, on a Saturday afternoon between December and April, Texaco would sponsor the Metropolitan Opera broadcast from here in New York, hosted by Milton Cross, with great performers in the operatic world doing their thing here in the Big Apple. And NBC, that's right, NBC formed its own opera company in the early 1950s, did several productions a year. The first one turned out to be a television classic, Amhal and the Night Visitors. It was produced live on Christmas Eve from a studio here in Brooklyn, New York, and it was sponsored by Hallmark Cards. It actually was the first presentation of what would be then known and forever known as the Hallmark Hall of Fame. It was so well received and so well watched that it became a Christmas tradition for years. Ever since, we've had on and off opera. We've had various specials with people like Maria Callas and Anna Mappo. We've had Joan Sutherland. We had a PBS special showcasing a PBS series showcasing opera for children in the 1970s. Of course, Live from the Met still plays as part of the great performances lineup on PBS stations across the country, Live from the Met, and in some cases from other places. And in recent years, All Arts, the public television service available on smart TV sets and smart devices, rigid by WAT 13 here in New York, has been at various opera programming. But they've never done anything like what people from All Arts will be seeing tonight at 10 p.m. the specific time. It is probably the first serialized dramatic opera series ever done for television. It's called Everything for Dawn. And joining me here in New York is the executive director of the organization that put this thing together called Experiments in Opera, Aaron Siegel. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks so much, Simon. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you. And joining us both, we are delighted to have the person who plays Dawn. She is a soprano, a singer, and songwriter. Her name is Britt Hewitt, and she also joins me here in New York. Hi, Britt.
Hey, Simon. How are you?
Very, very fine. Thank you. And thanks for jumping in on quick notice for the artistic director of Experiments in Opera and this project, Kabbalah Sankaran, who's supposed to be with us overnight. She had something happen, and we hope she's doing great, and we thank you for getting in. Aaron, what is Experiments in Opera all about, and how long has your organization been thinking about doing a serialized TV opera?
Well, thanks for that question, Simon. You know, in addition to being the executive director of Experiments in Opera, I am also a composer and one of the co-founders of the organization. I got together with a couple of other composers about 11 years ago, and much like many other composer groups have done over the years, decided to pool our resources to create a company that would support the creation and production of new operas. And so we have been working over the last 11 years. We have created over 70 works, operatic works over that time, all of them brand new. We focus specifically on working with composers to create new pieces that challenge singers, that challenge audiences to reconsider what the notion of opera is. And part of that has always been an understanding or a challenge of what the medium is and what the scale of the work is. So throughout the years, we've done projects that are more like sort of podcasts. We've done some radio-type shows with Foley sound guys, and we've also done some video operas, short films. And so we've always been interested in toying with the ways in which people are consuming media and consuming their art and stories and music these days, and trying to figure out ways to kind of sneak in opera under the radar, so to speak, and get people to listen and engage with opera like the way they do most sort of premiere television these days, by flipping on their TV and opening up an app and checking and see what episodes dropped. So that's been an ambition of ours, and this is the project that really felt like it all came together around.
Alex, Aaron, before we get to Britt, how does your organization and how does this particular project deal with, I guess, the stereotypes that have been floating around the opera scene for decades? Things like it can never get a mass audience, its audience is limited, people can't get into watching operas or, for 2 or 3 hours that are in other languages, not rather than English,
sure.
That are sung by people that don't represent the characters that the operas are supposed to showcase.
Sure.
How does your organization, and especially with this project, deal with making opera relevant, making it contemporary, and making it intimate and relatable to a TV audience?
I love that list of things because those are the things that we think about all the time. You know, every meeting that we have as an organization, and you know, we're a collective, and so we have all the composers who work with us and all of the community of artists who work in, you know, work with us. We get together and we chat about these things. What can we do to change some of the stereotypes or the understandings of what opera is? Now, I will say that there are some things that are just never going to change. If you're making opera and you're using a trained operatic voice, it's always going to sound somewhat like what it is. Now, there's lots of variations, and people have their own sort of takes on things, and certainly we've done projects where we don't necessarily use that same trained operatic voice, but that's something that I think is that people can get used to, and that actually becomes quite appealing if you kind of frame it right. One of the things that we do is we make sure that the stories that we tell are stories that feel like they're coming out of the imagination of our current, you know, crop of thinkers and artists. So we work with genre stories. We work with original stories. We try not to do that much of like sort of historical, you know, operas about so-and-so character and, you know, this pivotal moment in their life. That's the grand opera tradition, and we know that we're working in a much more independent, do-it-yourself, kind of a funky environment where we can create and tell stories that, you know, might have a place on a on TNT or on a Netflix show or something, but wouldn't necessarily read in the Metropolitan Opera House or in Chicago or whatever. So I think we're really aware of that. The other thing is, I think that we have worked really hard over the years to make building community and including different voices a central component of what we do. So this particular opera, the Everything for Dawn, was actually written by a writer's room. Usually opera is written by one librettist and one composer, and the librettist writes the libretto, then the composer takes the libretto and makes it into music. That's sort of a reduction of the process, but that's more or less what it is. And we knew that process and that model really eliminates the participation of so many more people. So we took this project and we said we're going to have six writers in a writer's room. They're going to work on the story together. They're going to use the same characters. They're going to tell the story over 10 episodes. And each librettist sort of wrote one or two episodes. And then they're going to pass each of those episodes off to 10 composers. So there's 10 different musical voices that are at play in this particular opera. This is a way for us to get the piece made more quickly. It was also a way for us to say, hey, you know, maybe this doesn't need to be one voice throughout. Maybe actually the power of this work can come from the sense of cumulative voice and cumulative storytelling that this community is bringing, and that we can understand and that our contemporary minds are capable of parsing, multiple voices, and that ultimately what matters is that we're telling a really powerful story about Dawn and about her experiences with her family and in the art world and growing up in Detroit, and that people will really sort of hang their hats on that, and then the music will allow them to sort of experience 10 different takes on what contemporary music and contemporary opera sounds like. And to us, that seems like, you know, just such a rich way of exploring this form and making it seem less monumental. It's much more about experiencing things, getting a taste of things, and then seeing how you respond and what to make of it.
Mm-hmm. Britt, what appealed to you about doing this character? And in a way, sort of having to immerse yourself in a television world where you're not only working with a composer, but you're also working in a writer's room environment where you have different writers, different composers, like many episodic TV shows.
Yeah, you know, when I saw the audition call for Experiments in Operas, Everything for Dawn, the character description was like 90s riot girl, college student, rebellious, sort of things that I never thought would be on the character description for a soprano role in an opera, right? And at the time, I'd buzzed my head, so I was super stoked about using that for the character. And I remember going in and doing the audition, and I happened to mention that, like, I was involved with a rock band at the time. I really wanted to emphasize that I had a connection to this character who, you know, was sort of rebellious and cool or whatever, but also an opera singer, like, you know, doing it in a classical voice. So I think it was really appealing to tell a story about sort of a normal teenager, like a very, very normal kind of story. We're not talking about Eurydice and Orpheus or Romeo and Juliet. It's just a 16 to 21-ish year old girl who is going through very real life struggles. And at the time, you know, we didn't know what the production was going to be like. I got to do all of the workshops with the composers and the writers, which is something that I've sort of specialized in the last few years or so. It's greatly rewarding to premiere new works and be a part of their fruition and creation. So I knew that was something that I loved and was good at. But I think in this case, there were 10 vastly different ideas of this one particular character. So not only did we have this one iteration, this one character that I could sink my teeth into, but we had 10 different viewpoints of who she was and litmus tests of the type of person she is in different scenarios. So I think that was incredibly appealing from the get-go. And then to film something, I've never been a TV actor. So to film something was, in every sense of the word, an experiment. To be smaller, you know, in a film space was stretching for me because I didn't have to project to the back of the house. You know, we were able to focus on music and acting sort of in isolation of one another. And so we could get really nitpicky and in the nitty-gritty of who Don was and who these characters were in relation to one another, which was fantastic.
Everything for Dawn. You could probably call it the first serialized TV drama or dramedy. That's operatic. And it premieres tonight on All Arts, the public television back service from WAT13 here in New York. It's available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. We're speaking with Aaron Singerl. He is the executive director of the organization that put this very ambitious project together, Experiments in Opera, which is based here in New York. And Britt Hewitt, the person who plays Dawn. And they're both with us live this half hour here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom Abman with you, also from the Big Apple on this Friday afternoon. Great to have you aboard. If you have a question or comment for our guest, make that phone ring, 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We have three episodes of the program about TV's current and future coming your way next week, Monday, Thursday, and Friday. And boy, we have a wonderful pre-Halloween theme edition for you coming up on Monday. First up, someone who deals in the world of scary television, movies, and other entertainment. Her name is Christine Madrid French. She has a brand new book out on the work of Alfred Hitchcock called The Architecture of Suspense. And she'll be with us as our lead guest. Look forward to hearing her thoughts about the scary TV stuff coming your way this month and beyond. Then, The Mole came back today on Netflix. Remember that ABC series with Anderson Cooper as the host? Well, now it is Alex Wagner of NBC, and we'll have the executive producer, Chris Kelvinor, with us. And he's also working on a brand-new game show. It may be the brainiest to be premiered sometime. It's called The Floor. It's a brand-new format from the creators of Deal or No Deal. Here's how it works in a nutshell. 100 people go for $1 million. And they have to go on various aspects of the floor. Each square of the floor deals with a particular category. And if one can outdo the other 99, that person walks away from the floor with the million. Chris will tell us about that. And finally, Hulu has got a very interesting made-for-TV Halloween film that deals with a very unusual monster, something off the Internet. The film is called Grin Cuddy. You'll meet the writer-director John William Rose. That's coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. What was the most unique thing and the most toughest thing, the biggest obstacle of putting this together when you're dealing with 10 composers, yourself and Kamal included? You have a writer's room, so you have different scriptwriters, and you have a director who I believe has done a lot of great operas in terms of theatrical, but I don't believe it's done television. So how do you deal with all those elements to make this thing together?
I think the hardest thing is just trusting the process. People who work in large collaborative spaces, like, you know, work in film or work on television, and even in opera houses, it's all a little different. But knowing that you have the right people in those positions, that they all have, you know, kind of their bailiwick, and they're going to be responsible for keeping track of the things that will make their departments work or to tell the story in a specific way, really trusting that process and making and really believing in it. Because this is such a huge group of people, not everyone always knew what the other people were doing. But I think at the end of the day, myself and the other producers at Experiments in Opera, Jason Keady is one of the co-founders and one of the composers and librettists as well, and our director, Allison Moritz, and director of photography, Eric Payton, we all got together and we had this brain trust, and we knew that we could do this. We knew that there was a way for us to tell the story in a compelling and succinct way, and we knew that we could do that at a really high level of artistry, both from a musical and a visual standpoint. So knowing that we all trusted each other and that we believed in the process was really challenging at times, but I think it also helped to make it feel like a project that was really born out of that process and born out of the minds and hearts, really, of many people, a group of people, as opposed to sort of one individual person who holds all the keys.
Was there any thought about using TV writers as librettists, at least one?
You know, we had a couple of writers who had worked in writers' rooms before, some playwrights. Krista Knight is one of our writers. Adrian Danrich, Jerome A. Parker, Jerry Lieblick, Lauren DeRico, and then Jason Cady. Our writers, they were really varied. Some of them were brand new right out of grad school, and they were working with plays. Some of them had worked on musicals. And we did a lot of research talking to people who had been in television writers' rooms and thought deeply about how our experience could be different and what was going to make it different. We knew that bringing to the table the story and the format the way that we were as the producing company, that we were going to be the quote-unquote showrunners of the show. So the three of us, Jason, Kamala, and I, were really the ones who were keeping track of, you know, where the characters were. We were the ones who generated the show Bible and were able to really keep track of what needed to happen in order for things to be coherent from episode to episode. But I think everyone in there had at least a sense of being able to be collaborative in a community and to really give feedback and to take feedback as it came. And I think that the show really developed. There's lots of really nice details that are present within the script and within the characters, so that over the course of the whole 10 episodes, you really get the sense of this whole world that's open. And it really is sort of a specific time and place of the 90s and in Detroit. And it kind of, the last part of it, the last three episodes take place right in 2001. You know, kind of, we were very intentional about wanting that to be right before 9/11, so that, because that was such a breaking point in our world in a certain way. And so there's things that happened before that and things that happened after that, and it was very important for us that this was a pre-internet space. This was a space where Don was growing up, and there was still a sense of innocence and still a sense of possibility that the 20th century and the 1990s really kind of embodied in many ways.
Rick, when I was watching one of the episodes, it's one of the first that people will see tonight, the 2.5-hour episodes that will run each week, one in a stand from All Arts, I got a sense of intimacy with you and the other characters. It reminded me of the early days of live television drama. It reminded me of shows like Insight, the Wonderful Rooms anthology series. We had one of the people involved with Father Elwood Kaiser, which did a lot of videotape work for most of its run, over 25 years. It also reminded me of some of the best moments of what Kirk Browning, the great live TV director, did with NBC Opera and then with Live from the Met, where you had these great close-ups, these great medium shots, where the characters, no matter where they were on stage, they felt like, you know, you were right next to them. I'm wondering, what kind of intimacy level did you find with the people around you, with the whole environment, when you did this performance?
Definitely. You know, as I was sort of mentioning, the stage is considerably smaller than what you would expect to find if you go to see an opera performance, right? So we had a little play space that we had to do a lot with, and so it was a challenge, but also really rewarding to embody these characters who we could just be people that. We could rely on the fact that that camera would be so close to us instead of trying to portray the emotion all the way to the last row of a house. And I think that we got super comfy super quick with one another as cast members. Some of these cast members I had been around since the first workshop in, March of 2020. So we had gotten to know each other really well. I play the youngest character in the series, and I am the youngest person consistently on set, and so I was really lucky to have been kind of adopted and made to feel welcome and like I was like I was a part of things from very early on. I think as far as, you know, cameras and acting, the intimacy levels were, you know, it was important to maintain true to like that sense of grounded humanity and experimenting with new and smaller emotions. You know, so much of an eye twitch is going to be picked up for TV, and you can really do a lot with that.
Aaron,
I'll just add to that.
I want to get into before we start wrapping. But you did this. This was taped last year, I understand. Was there any issues with the pandemic?
Yeah, what I was just going to say is that, like, you know, we did shoot this starting in December of 2021 after it had been delayed. And so we were, you know, sort of following very strict COVID protocols. And so that added to the sense of the level of intimacy. And I think it also added to the level of intensity. We were all really happy to be working, in a safe environment. And we really trusted and depended on each other. There was a small crew on set. And, you know, we were there for 3 weeks. We did have to sort of suspend our shoot at the end because some of our cast members did get COVID. And we continued and finished the shoot in March of this past year. So there were those hiccups that came, and I think that any production that was shooting at all in the last 2 years had some of those. There's no doubt about it. But it is, I think, added to both the excitement around it and also the sense of tension, in the sense that, you know, we were really excited and not desperate, but really wanted it to work. We really wanted to be able to make this piece the way that we wanted to, or that we knew that it could, based on our imaginations, but also, you know, tied to the reality of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. A number of years ago, we had the Dallas Opera on this program because they had formed a channel to really expand to a lot of people across the country what opera could be all about. It's not just performance. It's the behind the scenes. It's having maybe operatic stars as like characters in their own dramatic or sitcom series kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten proposals for, let's say, other TV opportunities for your organization?
Yeah.
And where do you see
a really good...
a bigger TV role for your organization in the road to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question, Simon. I mean, one of the things you mentioned earlier is, you know, sort of hinted at, is that the space of the opera world is inherently a conservative one. So there's a lot of a sense that they're trying to preserve this art form that's been around for hundreds of years, and it's very specific. You know, the Metropolitan Opera has 3,000-something seats, and they need to sell those seats, and so that's the way that they build their seasons. Now, they have already started to do, they just announced yesterday, I think, a new television effort. A lot of organizations have realized over the last couple of years that they need to figure out robust ways to engage with their audiences through digital means, and I think that's the closest way that we relate to this notion of television, or at least shooting and producing in that mode. I think there's going to be more of that, but I also think that one of the things that I credit the folks that are All Arts with is recognizing that that's not necessarily going to come from the larger companies, because they have all that legacy to really deal with. So it's companies like ours that are doing this small work that can really kind of expand and think imaginatively about what the form can be and not what it has been. And I think that that's really where the potential for, you know, more filmed and more television-oriented work can come from. I do think it's a very specific way of working, and there are a lot of challenges around it. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. We are eager as a company to get back in front of some live audiences, because that is part of what we do. And so this current season has a couple of live productions, but you can bet that we are going to continue to produce work that it will sort of play in a television-like environment, whether or not it plays uses with the writer's room or not. I think that remains to be seen. But both we're going to do that, and I think that other companies are going to continue to do that. And also, we have gotten some calls from people, from some big companies that have said, hey, we like what you're doing. We think this is the right way to go. How can we make this work? And I think, you know, the future will tell what that looks like and how those production models change over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the meantime, we may be seeing a groundbreaking breakthrough in the area of opera on television starting tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern time on All Arts. That's the public television channel available on smart TV sets and devices, 10-episode series, and it's called Everything for Dawn with Rick Hewitt in the title role. Also, by the way, involved in it is two-time Grammy Award nominee Aaron Engelbrecht, who plays the father of Dawn, who committed suicide in this. And the scenes with him and her are really outstanding. I think you'll really like this program very, very much. And I think we'll open some new possibilities for the medium. Again, starts tonight, 10 p.m. Pacific time, 2 half-hour episodes for screening. And if you want to know more information about the series and all the attractions, you can find All Arts. Here's where you go online, allarts.org. That's allarts.org. And if you want to find out more about Aaron's organization, what they're doing, go to experimentsinopera.com. That's experimentsinopera.com. Aaron Siegel, Britt Hewitt, thank you both very much for coming on this half hour. Britt, good luck with your role, and there's hopefully much more store on your opera and singing and song career. And Aaron, thank you again for joining us, and all the very best to you and your organization. Hopefully more TV work to come.
Thanks very much, Simon.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Take care, both of you. Have a fantastic weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Aaron Siegel, the executive director of Experiments and Opera, and Britt Hewitt, the star of Everything for Dawn. She plays Dawn, which premieres tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern time on All Arts. Again, that's available on smart TV sets and smart devices, and both of us joined us from here in New York. And when we come back, we will have the son of a celebrated episodic TV writer. Wait to hear about some of the episodes he did. And in his honor, Mr. Peter Burke, that's the son, has just come out with a brand new novel, which could become, in its own way, a television series. The novel is Time Lock, and Peter joins us live from Los Angeles after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogs.radio.com, streaming.com, and tune.com. Together, reaching over 70 million listeners around the world every month and growing. If you want a very unusual musical exercise, check out A Night with Daddy G tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. It's a Blog Talk Radio special. A Night with Daddy G tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, that's the BTR always available to you 24/7 at youtube.com. More available than before on smart TV sets and devices. Welcome back to our second half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. 90-minute edition to wrap up your week. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. Happy you're aboard. If questions or comments for our guests ahead, make that call, 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name, Marshall B12 already in the room. Our next guest this half hour is the son of a very celebrated episodic TV writer who made his mark in the 1970s with shows like Mission Impossible, The Rockford Files, McMillan Wife, and another element of the mystery movie series on NBC, Columbo. His name was Howard Burke. And joining me live to talk about his father's work and a work he has just co-authored called Time Lock, which could become a television series not too far down the road, Peter Burke. Peter, welcome in from L.A. And there you go. Welcome in.
Thanks so much. Great to chat with you.
Same here, Peter. Tell us about Time Lock and how you see it as an homage to your father.
Well, we wrote it first as a screenplay many years ago, and I always thought it was a great concept, and it was my dad's, not mine. But unfortunately, you know, the timing wasn't right. Everybody was making, sequels or comic book adaptations or superhero movies, so it was tough to get a big budget action, you know, picture off the ground. And so we moved on to other things. And then when COVID hit and I was stuck at home like everybody else with a lot of, you know, time on my hands, I thought, you know, what better way to honor my dad than to novelize the screenplay. And that's exactly what I did. And I was fortunate enough to be aligned with a great publisher, Ingram Elliott. And they nurtured the project and believed in it. And it just has been an incredibly rewarding experience, you know, primarily because, as I said, it's just all about honoring my dad.
What is Time Lock all about? I understand it's set in a future world where certain people have something happen to them on the spot that they are unaware, they're unprepared for, and it could impact the rest of their lives and the world at large.
Actually, the concept was it's set about 10 years in the future, and crime is pretty much out of control, and prisons are greatly overcrowded. So one governor in particular, who's sort of the villain of the piece, pushes through this radical new program in her state of Maryland that it's a genetic acceleration technology. So the basic idea is that a prisoner is instantly aged the number of years of their sentence. So, you know, it's the ultimate deterrent because, you know, three strikes and you're old, basically. So it's very effective and very frightening. And our hero is one of the first to go through the program. He's wrongly, falsely arrested for murder and given a 40-year sentence, but he manages to escape halfway through. So it's really a story less about technology or, you know, it has obviously a sci-fi element to the concept, but we really wanted to tell a story about what it would be like to be 23 when you wake up in the morning and 43 in the afternoon, you know, and on the run from the authorities and, you know, your life in danger and up against this, you know, huge cabal of you know, criminals who may run all the way up to the White House. So it's really an action-adventure story with romance and hopefully a good deal of humor. We didn't want to make it too heavy despite the premise.
Mm-hmm. What is the chance that the Time Lock will become a television series? What have the critics' reaction to the book been, and are you getting any nibbles from anybody about adapting it for TV?
It just came out, you know, the few reviews we've had have been very positive, but it's too soon to know. Obviously, that would be great. It's actually the first in a series of five novels, so there's plenty of material to make it a limited series that goes beyond just this first book. I wish I had an answer for you. I'd love to come back on soon and tell you, you know, that that deal is set, but that's definitely what we're working toward. And there is a screenplay, you know, the original screenplay exists, and two of the sequels already have screenplays because they also were based on scripts I wrote with my dad. So there's a lot of material to work with, and if anybody's interested, it's definitely available.
And the book is Time Lock. It's published by Ingram Elliott Publishing, and we've got the co-author, Peter Burke, who authored with his late father, Howard Burke. We're going to talk about his career in television, which had a bunch of very interesting shows involved, from the Rockford Files to some of the best episodes of Columbo. We're going to get to that shortly. And Peter joins us live from Los Angeles this half hour, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New York, 73 degrees, top of the hour. Happy to have you aboard to wrap up your week. Hope you have a great weekend in store. By the way, thoughts and prayers continue for all the people dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Ian in Florida, the Carolinas, and so on. And if you have a question or comment for Peter, make that phone call go, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. The CW started its latest season earlier this week with the premiere of a popular series in Canada coming to the U.S. for the first time called Family Law. 1 week from today on Tomorrow Be Televised, next Friday, we've got the creator and executive producer, Susan Nielsen. She will join us live. That's Susan Nielsen from Family Law, now on the CW, next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. What was life like for your father dealing in the world of 1970s episodic TV writing?
I think he thrived in it. He was always, you know, a very gifted writer, far, far better than I'll ever be. And he had written a couple of novels, and he was befriended by Bruce Lansbury, Angela's brother, who was a big executive at Paramount, and suggested that we move out here. We were living in Connecticut in the late 60s. And one of his first jobs was on Mission Impossible. And it was, you know, he ended up in that genre pretty much. And the shows were very, very difficult to write. You know, if you can imagine, everything, you know, 100 different pieces had to come together like a jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, but he loved it. And, you know, it just kept building from there. And I think Columbo was you know, was a particular highlight. He loved working on those. He and Peter Falk became good friends. And I think he had a great time, you know, throughout, because, you know, it allowed him to really venture into, he never did sitcoms, but he tried to inject humor even into some of these serious shows. And so he really got to explore a lot of different styles and, you know, and really work in many different genres. And it was a pleasure watching him work, and that, you know, he was working on shows that I loved as a kid, and, you know, and so it was exciting. You know, I wanted to know, you know, what's going to happen at the end, you know, before the script was even written. So it was a great, you know, we were incredibly close, and then I had the great good fortune of working with him, so that was amazing.
I want to go back to Columbo and also the Rockford Files, because a lot of his work was for Universal Television back in their glory days in the early and mid-1970s. But go back to Mission Impossible. For those who don't know, Bruce Lansbury, you mentioned, was Angela Lansbury's brother. He was also involved, I think, first with Desilu, then when it was acquired by Paramount in the mid-1960s when Star Trek came around and so forth. He was very much involved with shows over there. Mission Impossible is now considered probably one of the classic and most difficult shows to write, because of the fact you have this impossible missions force by its very nature dealing with impossible missions. And you had a lot of – the direction was very taut. Of course, Lalo Schifrin's great score. You had Bruce Geller, the creator executive producer, really was someone who was – very much fixed on, we have to get this as perfect as possible. What was it like for him to write under that condition, to do an episode for them?
I mean, you're absolutely right. You obviously know everything about it. What I remember a couple of aspects of, I think he wrote two or three, my dad. And I remember that it was very difficult. I mean, the show was so set in its ways, and it worked, obviously, that, you know, that I remember him fighting, you know, in a friendly way, not with Bruce or even the show. I think it was more with the network, because he wrote an episode that didn't end with them all, you know, high-fiving and walking off or whatever they normally did. It actually ended on a personal note with the episode was called Encounter, and I can't remember all the details. But for just to have this slightly different ending was, you know, huge. It was, you know, an uproar at the network, and, you know, and that, and I remember that, and I also remember that my dad wrote an episode, and the title of which I can't remember, but he actually had Greg Morris was posing as a singer, and he got to perform a couple of songs, and about a year later, he met my dad. You know, they hadn't met during the filming. He met my dad at a party, and when he found out that my father had written that episode, he gave him a kiss on the cheek and a big hug. Thank you for letting me do something other than turn a screwdriver, you know. He was so grateful, you know, but that's the way the shows were. They were very, you know, they, as I said, they were set in their ways, but hard to argue with success. And they were very difficult to write, you know, as you mentioned. But very rewarding.
When your father was working for Universal Television on shows like The Rockford Files, like McMillan White, one of the NBC mystery movie series in rotation, and then Columbo, how much interaction did he have with stars like Peter Falk or directors or other writers or producers like Richard Levinson, William Link, who created Columbo, and I should say also did some of the very best made-for-TV movies ever, like The Execution of Private Slovak and That Certain Summer. I mean, Universal at the time had really great writers and producers doing a lot of their shows. Stephen Cannell doing, or Roy Huggins doing The Rockford Files, for example.
Yeah, no, an amazing roster of talent. You know, writers were kind of kept at arm's length. You know, I don't remember my dad being on the set, or, you know, I was only 12 or 13 at the time, but so I wasn't privy to, you know, every meeting he went to. So But I don't think there was much interaction, you know, certainly not with the stars other than with Peter Falk. And, you know, writers did their thing and, you know, went back and forth with rewrites. And but I don't think they were particularly welcome on the set. I don't even know that that's changed that much since then on certain sets. But it wasn't like a sitcom where everybody is sitting around, you know, watching rehearsals and rewriting lines on the spot. You know, so he was, but he loved, as I said, he really, you know, thrived in the whole environment. But with Peter, who, you know, was himself a writer and very involved with, you know, with every script, I know he, you know, interacted with him, and that's how they became friendly. And by coincidence, I ended up handling PR for Peter Falk 10 years later, having nothing to do with my dad, and, you know, found him totally delightful, very Columbo-like in real life, too, but he was great.
Did your father, was he able to pick and choose what shows he wanted to work with, or was it a case of whatever I can get, I got to get?
No, I think, you know, I think once he established himself on some of those really top-tier prestige shows, you know, they came calling to him. You know, there are a few I'm sure he took that helped pay the bills or whatever, but you know, he had no shortage of, you know, opportunities. He reached a point where he felt it was a bit of a grind, and he also wanted to, you know, write novels and screenplays, which he did. But that 70s period, I think he worked on many of those top shows, except, you know, I think he probably would have loved working on a, you know, Mary Tyler Moore or All in the Family or something, but once you're known for a certain type of, you know, genre, it's hard to get, you know, to break, cross over into another, but he had a great time.
Were there any personal favorites? I got a sense looking at Wikipedia this afternoon that he was a big fan of McMillan & Wyeth and Rock Hudson, Susan Vey James. I understand four scripts for that program, I think, in the third or fourth or fifth seasons. Show ran 6 years on NBC. And certainly Columbo. Did he ever say, like, if they were personal favorites and why?
I think he would, you know, talk mostly about the two Columbos because – they really came out very well. The first one was called By Dawn's Early Light, and it was set in a military academy, and Patrick McGoohan, who won an Emmy for the part, I think it was his first of many, many appearances in front of and behind the camera related to Columbo. And he played a, you know, military academy commander who, you know, killed somebody, and it was a great episode. Bruno Kirby was in it, and my dad loved the way that turned out. It was one of the few Columbos that was set, you know, outside L.A. or, you know, in a different location. I think it was filmed back east, and I think he really also liked the other one he worked on, a road called The Conspirators, which turned out to be the last of the original run of Columbo before they brought it back 10 years later on ABC. And I think he that was about an Irish gun runner. And what he really liked about that one is it's one of the, there were a few Columbos like this, but I think in this particular episode, if anyone who's listening remembers, you know, he really liked the murderer, you know, which is unusual. Obviously he doesn't like that he killed someone. And the man is arrested, of course, but they have this sort of playful banter, and that, you know, he's sorry that it has to end that way. And my dad liked injecting, you know, warmth and humor, you know, whenever possible, even into a Mission Impossible or shows that weren't, you know, exactly laugh riots. And I think Peter liked both of those as well. And I know Patrick McGoohan certainly liked the one he was in, especially when he won an Emmy for it. So I think.
And I remember that portrayal, you know, Peter. And two things I remember that episode. One is that McGowan came off as this sort of honorable murderer. You know, you hate the fact he murdered somebody, but you like the fact that he was like sort of had a moral code, if you will. You know, honor, duty bound, so on and so forth. And he sort of displayed that, like, from start to finish in his Emmy-winning portrayal. And the other thing I liked, too, was the way it ended. It ended sort of in a very quiet way. I believe it had a cannon in the center of the square in that
right.
Military academy. And I believe the camera went to that square, focused on that cannon, as there was, like, a military, you know, drum roll rolling on the soundtrack. And then it fades to – and then it has the credits and fades to black. Did he write that, by the way, to have it end that way? You know, sort of this very quiet, you know, just focus on the canon.
I think he did. I can't absolutely remember. You know, it was very well directed by Leo Penn. And, you know, I can't.
Sean Penn's father, by the way. Let's make sure we get the credit. And one of the very best episodic TV directors. Did Ben Casey, did a lot of great shows.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, everything in Columbo's in a Columbo script was, you know, pretty nailed down. So I would imagine he wrote it that way, and it would be consistent with the way, as I've been saying, where he liked to veer a little bit away from formula, and you know, and you. I think my dad would have been less interested in writing a Columbo where somebody kills somebody just for money or greed or jealousy or something like that. He always wanted to put in the, as you said, rightly, you know, the moral code, or, you know, and same thing in the conspirators. He thinks he's doing it for his country. I mean, there's always that extra element. I don't think my father was interested in just, you know, black and white evil, you know, kinds of stories.
Peter Burke, the co-author of the new novel, Time Lock, which could become a television series, you never know. He's our guest this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, joining us live from Los Angeles. The book is published by Ingram Elliott Publishing, and it's available now, I'm sure, at Amazon, other places as well. And if you have a question or comment remaining this with Peter, make a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. And coming up before the top of the hour, classic trivia question of the week. Last time we're offering a specific question. Three prizes in play, two book prizes, and the AMC Network's new notepad with Case. So all that can come your way if you know the answer to our questions. So stay tuned. Get your thinking caps on. You could be our next classic trivia winner. Did I read right that one of the last series that your father wrote for was The Beastmaster? That was a syndicated adventure drama with Mark Singer playing the title role?
No. He didn't work on that, but you did see – you did see Beastmaster in the material about the book, but it was because my dad wrote and produced a series called The Contender with the star of the Beastmaster, Mark Singer, from you know, which you know most people know from V, the original V miniseries, sci-fi series. So that's why that was in the you know material. But no, he didn't work on Beastmaster.
He did do some made-for-TV movies, though.
Yeah, he did one called Advice for the Lovelorn with Cloris Leachman and a few others. And then he wrote a feature called Target with Gene Hackman and Matt Dillon. And unfortunately, that one was a case where they went off and kind of rewrote some of his much better writing, frankly, and that, you know, some of the endings didn't work as well as I wish they had stuck with his original script, but there's, you know, still very good piece of work. And, you know, and then, as I said, right after that is when we started writing together. And, you know, what became Time Lock was one of the first projects. And then we did about three or four other scripts that I've also adapted as sequels to Time Lock because they're so somewhat similar. So hopefully people will read this. It's deliberately a short, you know, Ingram Elliott puts out what they call IE snaps. They're short novellas, you know, just a couple hundred pages, and they're very cinematic. in nature. So I hope somebody's listening that wants to, you know, consider it for TV or a movie, because that's how it originally started, actually.
What do you think he? What do you think your father would make of the current scene of science fiction on television? I'm curious if he was ever asked to do a script for a science fiction series. And what do you think of the current, you know, role of science fiction, fantasy, horror series? I mean, we have now, you know, the ability to do shows like House of the Dragon on HBO and The Lord of the Rings on Prime Video, both of which are major monster hits so far in their early in their run. But it seems that we, in the last, let's say, 30, 40 years, we've had this incredible renaissance of this, you know, all the Star Trek shows, the Star Wars series on Disney Plus, the Marvel shows, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd be as hugely impressed as I am. I mean, TV is amazing now. I mean, what you can watch is beyond anything, you know, he would have imagined or I could have imagined. There's great, great television. And, you know, Star Trek was always a personal favorite. And so I think he'd be, you know, very impressed with Strange New Worlds or most any of the recent ones. In fact, just as a side note, by coincidence, my dad was approached at one point to write a Star Trek feature film, and not the first one that they eventually made at all, but it was too big budget, and this was before Star Wars, so it was kind of scrapped, and then they ended up going in a different direction. But you know, my dad's first novel was called The Sun Grows Cold, which was a figurative title. It's not a literal one, but it was definitely science fiction, you know, Logan's Run-ish. So he loved the genre, and yeah, I think he'd be, you know, incredibly impressed. Hard not to be.
And what would he think, and you think now, about, for example, the dramatic step forward in procedurals and other types of dramatic shows, whether it's Law and Order, whether it's Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue, The Sopranos, dramedies like Orange is the New Black. What do you think about what has happened with all of these sort of genre and subgenres that have popped up in the area of scripted TV?
I mean, the evolution has been remarkable, you know, just in a short span of time. You know, that's why you get A-list stars who are more than happy to be on TV. I think it's just exploded in quality. And, you know, whenever I hear people kind of in a snobby way saying, oh, I never watched television, it really bothers me, not just because I grew up and appreciate, you know, having grown up in that world, you know, what talent goes into it. But to me, it's so dismissive that it's just like, are you really dismissing the incredible quality? Have you watched anything in the last 15 years? Of course, there's junk on. There are terrible books. There are terrible movies. There are terrible songs. But, you know, anyone who's really watched television, you know, in recent years or even in the last 40 years, you know, I don't know how you can't be incredibly impressed. So much creativity and talent go into it. And, you know, for those of us like you and me who really, you know, are kind of behind the scenes, it's hard not to appreciate how much work and skill are involved in bringing these shows to life.
The name of the book is Time Lock. It is co-authored by Peter Burke and his late father, Howard Burke, wonderful, prolific 1970s episodic TV writer. It's published by Ingram Elliott Publishing. It may very well become a television series. Certainly hope so. If you want more details about the book, two places to go. You can go to www.ingrainelliott.com. That's www.ingrainelliott.com. By the way, the book, I'm sure, is on Amazon. Also at best-selling stores all over the place. You can also go to a company that Peter Burke is a co-partner in called HotIceMedia.com. That's HotIceMedia.com. And if Time Lock does become a television series in some way, we'll definitely have Peter Burke to tell us all about it back on this program. Peter, it's been a wonderful treat to have you on. Thank you so much for all your thoughts. Congratulations on this book. I do hope it becomes a series, and we'd love to have you back anytime. It's been a great, great pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you, Simon, so much, and have a great weekend. Take care.
You too. All the greatest. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Peter Burke, joining us live from Los Angeles. When we come back, classic trivia question of the week, we have our very special takeaway of the week, the growing movement of alternate sports presentations. And we have a show to know, a very unusual one that actually was not on television, but it was live streamed. And it was Yom Kippur services here in New York that were unlike any I think you will ever see. And they should get a national audience through smart TV sets and devices. We'll tell you all about that. And in our up segment, something happened today for somebody that we featured on this program way back when he broke into the medium with a series for USA Network called Colony. That's all coming up after we pause, top of the hour, right here for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com. Together, reaching over 70 million listeners around the world every month and growing. If you love classic horror suspense radio, check out Eerie House Radio today, 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 Pacific. That's Eerie House Radio. It's a great showcase for the best of old-time radio drama of the suspenseful kind. 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 Pacific, here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best VTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Available more and more on smart TV sets and devices. Welcome back to our final half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. Tommy Abbott with you live from New Web, New York. It is 73 degrees at the top of the hour. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Good to have you with us. We have a number of features to do before we wrap things up for the week and the weekend. And if you have a question or comment along the way, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tune Radio. We're getting to our chat room, as Marshall B12 has done. It's Simon Apple 04 by name, and you will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the show is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tune and Screen, follow the instructions of Disney Live with you. Before we get to our takeaway of the week, our show to know, our up segment, and other things too, let's give you our classic trivia question. Last time we're offering it, we've been doing it for nearly 2 weeks. We have three prizes in play. Two of them are books. Tune in tomorrow, the new book by former guest on this program, Randy Dawn, and Flirting with Fame, wonderful book about the Hollywood scene from one of its best public relations people ever, the iconic guru himself, Dan Harari, also on this program. And we have the new AMC Networks Notepad, beautiful book for you, and it also is a great case, too, that you can store it in. And all that will come your way if you know the answer to this question. What 1971 CBS series starred David Janssen as a U.S. government agent? What 1971 CBS series starred David Janssen, the fugitive? Some of you may remember him way back when as Richard Diamond, Private Eye, or Harry O. Wonderful series, ran two seasons on ABC. What series starred David Janssen, 1971 on CBS, ran 1 year, as a U.S. government agent? Two quick hints. Number one, U.S. is in the title. Number two, Jack Webb, Dragnet himself, was the executive producer. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember to enclose your name and your mailing address. If you win, we get the prize out to you as soon as possible. If we don't get a winner by the end of today, we'll post the question tomorrow morning first thing on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook is Simon Applebaum. Twitter, UBC Simon, PWBT. We're on the precipice of getting 800 followers. One more. And hopefully we'll get that maybe by the end of the weekend. So one more time, here's the question. What 1971 CBS series starred David Janssen as a U.S. government agent? Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com, and close that name and address. If you're a previous winner, you're not eligible. Incidentally, I do want to credit Ryan Lerman. He was a previous winner from Coral Springs, Florida. He emailed me yesterday with, in fact, the correct answer. So, Ryan, unfortunately, can't win this time around because you've won, I think, twice before. And thank you for contributing the answer. You were absolutely on the money from Coral Springs, Florida. And thanks for continuing to listen to our show. So remember, in order to win, play in. Do it today. And all the very best. And now it's time for our regular feature, the takeaway of the week, where on regular Fridays, we showcase a development or two that took place during the week that we think you ought to keep in mind taking away from this week as something that will impact how you watch and use television. Have you noticed that more and more often when you watch a sporting event, you can watch it in different ways on more than one channel? take this past Saturday when, if you were watching the Clemson-North Carolina State game on Saturday Night Football on ABC, if you tuned to ESPN2, you could watch the game plus commentary from Pat McAfee and his Pat McAfee Show colleagues. Also, they had a special sports center at halftime. Well, that's one of the latest examples of what I've been calling the alternative sports presentation movement, where you get the chance to see an event in more than one way on more than one network. And this is something that you're seeing more and more and more. It didn't start out that way. It used to be something you would just find maybe once or twice a year just a few years ago. Remember the megacast, where if you watched March Madness, the game on CBS or TBS or TNT or True TV, that on those other servers I just mentioned, you would get, let's say, a version of the game with stats surrounding the screen, or you would have one version where you saw the picture like everybody else, but the commentary was from the play-by-play team representing one of the schools in the Final Four or in the Final Two, and another one with the announcers from the alternate school or the competing school, if you will. And, of course, we've had for the last couple of years college football with the megacast and the college football playoffs, where you had, again, the main game on ESPN, the main game feed, I should say, then the stat-laden version on ESPN2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This movement really started to go beyond the once-in-a-great-while mode to more than that over a year ago when Nickelodeon, in the winter of 2021, decided we're going to do a National Football League playoff game that's on CBS on Nickelodeon. And we're going to add elements to the Nickelodeon presentation and make it great for kids. Like, we're going to explain how football works, about the rules, about the players, and what they do. And when the players score a touchdown, Lime is going to be all over the end zone. And we're going to have a different sports production team, and we're going to have different play-by-play people. In this case, Noah Eagle, the son of one of the best play-by-play people around right now, Ian Eagle, saw him last night doing the Brooklyn Nets preseason game on the YES Network. He also does Thursday Night Football on Westwood One. And, of course, he's also the number two or number three commentator, a number play-by-play person on CBS's coverage of the NFL on Sundays. Excuse me. Well, that worked really great. They decided to do it again this past January, and now they're going to be doing it again this December for a regular season game for the very first time due to the great response from Nickelodeon viewers. Then last fall, we had Monday Night Football with Peyton and Eli Manning, where a number of times during the course of Monday Night Football on ESPN, if you watched ESPN2, you'd see the view of the game, plus you would also see Peyton and Eli Manning sitting on their couches or their sofas talking about the game, having special guests like Tom Brady or people from athletes from other sports come in and do their thing, talk about the game, talk about their love of football, what they're doing in their lives. And it was fun, and it still is. And that's continuing. And, in fact, Peyton Manning's production company, Omaha, is now doing the same thing over the last year with golf championships, with Sunday Night Baseball, with the Michael K, the K-Bar, or K-Rod, excuse me, experience with Michael K, the Yankees play-by-play person on the YES Network, and Alex Rodriguez, former Yankee, former baseball superstar. And that's worked out pretty well. So you're seeing more and more of these alternative sports presentations, whether it is a different way of showing the game with other athletes talking about it, or whether it is with lots of stats, or whether it's camera angles, you can pick the camera angle you want to see, or in more recent times, sports betting information. That's exactly what happened last Saturday when Marquee Sports Network, the Sinclair-owned regional sports network featuring Chicago Cubs baseball, presented through smart TV sets and devices, not through the regional net itself, a version of a game with the Cubs where surrounding the screen was betting information on individual players, on the participating teams, on other teams playing that day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You might say it's sort of a prelude to the possibility that when enough states, a mass amount of the 50 states, except sports betting, that you'll be able to use those stats and place bets on the games using your voice or your voice remote through your smart TV set or smart TV device. The bottom line here is that we are now in an era that's not going away. This alternative sports presentation movement is here, and it is here to stay. And ultimately, because of sports betting, because of interactivity, it is going to go way beyond. It's going to go way beyond just what we think now. You're going to have the ability to talk to players after they hit a home run in the dugout. You'll have the opportunity to place bets before, during, and after games. You'll have the opportunity to what they call gamification, play unique games in sports, or maybe put yourself in the action, playing your own sports game in baseball or basketball or football or hockey as time goes by and as interactivity develops and we get more into this interactive TV era. Let's face it, the way we see sports is moving toward a whole new future. And these presentations are just the start. I will say this. I was not happy personally with the Pat McAfee presentation on ESPN2 Saturday night. I thought that the people talked over each other, too much movement. I thought that sometimes the conversation got away. I think there has to be some reining in of what you do while you're watching the action. In between, okay, while the action's happening, put the focus where it belongs, on the game. And let's see what happens. Again, no question, we are going to see a dramatic expansion of how we see a sports event and where we see a sports event. It's no longer a one channel for everything. It's going to be many channels covering the same event in different ways. And ultimately, fingers crossed, it's a good thing. I'd love to hear what you think about alternative sports presentations. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. And if you want to respond to what I just said, well, give us a call right now. It's 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, simonapple04 by name. Now it's time for our regular feature, a show to know, where we highlight a program that is popping up that we think you ought to watch. We think you'd enjoy it if you did. And it's a show that either is not well marketed, promoted, publicized, or falls on the radar screen of TV journalists and critics. This one's very special because yours truly joined other people of Jewish persuasion this past Tuesday night and through Wednesday to mark Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. Last year, I decided to do something different for the very first time. I decided rather than go, at least for one service, to my local synagogue or one of my local synagogues, was on a recommendation from people in my family to check out a service that was live streamed by an organization called Central Synagogue in Midtown Manhattan. And I saw part of their Yom Kippur service last fall, and it was amazing. I've never seen a service like this. It was a service that had a remarkable building, remarkable rabbis, and a cantor. And many of the prayers were done in musical styles that range from Stephen Schwartz Godspell or Broadway musicals to the kind of music that Dave Grusin did for his scores for On Golden Pond or Tootsie or St. Elsewhere. And they were wonderful renditions of classic Jewish prayers, very faithful, and just beautifully done. Well, I did it again this time, except I did it both for the opening service Tuesday evening and for the morning service that took place the following morning, Wednesday. And it was even better. The camera work was terrific. The rabbis were marvelous. They had individuals from the congregation read the Torah on Wednesday morning. And they had a cantor who's I've never seen before, but boy, what a voice. And what a way to hold high notes, including very classic prayers. It was mesmerizing. There was a choir, pianist, organist, and at one point, when the Torah is, after it comes out of the ark and there are prayers for it, it goes around the congregation in most of the synagogue. There was a quartet of a cello player, I'm sorry, an oboe player, a drummer, a pianist, and a bass player, kid you not, and they were playing a medley of songs. One was a song you would find at, let's say, a wedding ceremony or, you know, people doing the horror, you know, or what they call the grapevines for celebration. Then there was one that had a prayer that was really neat, wonderful musical arrangement. And then another, and then wrapping it up with one that, again, looked like, sounded like something from Day by Day or another great song from Godspell by Stephen Schwartz. I never thought I'd see the day when you would see that kind of Torah service include that kind of wonderful, spirited music. And it really lifted the whole service and everybody there. That's the kind of service Central Synagogue does. And it does so on a wonderful scale that I would love to see other synagogues do around the country. Unfortunately, you had to go to the website or go to Yahoo or Google to find the live stream and then take it off. I hope that next year they will do it on smart TV sets or smart devices. Incidentally, Central Synagogue tonight does have its Friday night service, which begins the Sabbath, which continues until Saturday afternoon, on a cable network called Jewish Broadcasting Service. It's ran twice. It's presented live from here in New York at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, and then repeated at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific. I think it's an hour, 90-minute program. And if you want to find out more about this service, you can either do one of two things. Go to www.centralsynagogue.org or go to Jewish Broadcasting Service's own website at jbstv.org. That's www.centralsynagogue.org or jbstv.org. I would like to make a recommendation to Jewish Broadcasting Service. Take Central Synagogue's feed next Yom Kippur, next Rosh Hashanah, High Holy Days, and bring it to the nation of the world. You should know that this live stream reaches a big audience all over the country, all over not just the United States but Canada. There are people watching from South Africa, from Asia, from other parts of Africa, from Europe, England, France. Amazing. And by the way, if you'd like to make a contribution to have these High Holy Day services happen in live stream or on television, go to centralsynagogue.org and make a donation. They will definitely appreciate it very, very much. And congratulate the Central Synagogue for really outstanding work, both the content and how it's covered by the TV camera. Really marvelous. And finally, before we leave you, let's give you a new segment of Up as an update where we catch up on guests and topics on this program. 6 years ago, January to be exact, 2016, we introduced you to a very promising writer-producer named Ryan Condal. At the time, Ryan was doing his first television series. It was on USA Network. It was called Colony. It was a near-future saga set in Los Angeles. And it dealt with some very strange, otherworldly happenings in and around that city. Ryan got great reviews for the program. He was on our show. He was a marvelous guest. And the show ran 3 seasons on USA. Ryan has had a marvelous career ever since because he got involved with George R.R. Martin, the creator of Game of Thrones. And when the time came for HBO to finally greenlight a prequel series called House of the Dragon, which they did, Ryan became executive producer and one of the co-showrunners. And he's done a whale of a job. The show premiered in late August on HBO, also replayed on HBO Max, and now on its various platforms averages, get this, 29 million people watching a week. You better believe around any time next year, House of Dragon is going to get its big share of Emmy Award nominations. Earlier today, Ryan Condal extended his contract with HBO, where not only will he continue showrunner of House of the Dragon, starting with the second season, which is now in pre-production, he will also develop more programs for HBO and probably for HBO Max. Very well-deserved honor. Ryan, way to go. and you are welcome on this program anytime. Also, before we leave you, I want to join other people at Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker and TuneIn Radio and all of our podcast affiliates and the rest of the radio world in offering our condolences to the family of Bernard McGuirk on his passing yesterday after a courageous battle with prostate cancer. For years, I woke up to the IMUS in the Morning program. Many years ago in the 70s on WNBC 66, and then a long time later on Sports Radio 66, WFAN. Loved IMUS in the Morning, loved the offbeatness, the craziness going on with IMUS and Charles McCord, who was not only a great news anchor person on radio, also a wonderful humorous writer. And IMUS had a way with interviews, and he had a way with, you know, crossing the, you know, towing the line or getting up to the line with outrageous humor. And some of the best bits were done by Bernard McGuirk, who started as a producer on the show and then became executive producer all through the years when it was simulcast on MSNBC, then RFD TV, and then finally on Fox Business Network. And it was Bernard McGuirk who came up with some of the best moments of the IMUS in the Morning program, playing Cardinal O'Connor. Who could ever forget his outrageous, and I do mean outrageous, portrayal of Cardinal O'Connor with IMUS? They were moments that were side-splitting and just made you laugh your you-know-what off. Just fantastic. In recent years, McGuirk appeared on various television programs and in the last few years did a morning radio show here in the Big Apple on WABC Radio with his former IMUS in the Morning sports partner, Sid Rosenberg. He had been off the air with Sid doing solo for several months because of his situation with prostate cancer. And apparently, it looked like earlier this week the end was near. Bernard passed away yesterday. He had complications also, not just with prostate cancer, but other things as well, with emphysema. He was surrounded by his family, his wife, his kids, friends as well, and we're all remembering him. Bernard was one kind of a character, and behind the character, I understand he was a very wonderful human being, a very giving person, and someone who really wanted to have the world be a more humorous place, even in times of craziness. He certainly accomplished that with IMUS and on his own and also with Sid Rosenberg in recent years at WABC. The radio world has lost a marvelous talent. And if there is any solace, it's that I'm sure that Bernard is reunited with IMUS. And, oh, God, the radio, the routines they are creating right now. They will be, I'm sure, very funny to all up there. In the meantime, our deep condolences to Bernard's wife, his family, and the millions of wonderful listeners, and we're very fortunate to catch his terrific work with IMUS and with Sid Rosenberg. He will be profoundly missed. I want to thank all of our guests for being here this Friday afternoon, all of you for tuning in. We got three big episodes of Tomorrow Be Televised coming your way next week. We're going to be on Monday, Thursday, and Friday. Big week here in New York, Diversity Week. DPAA has a conference at Chelsea Piers where Law and Order is filmed and other things happening as well. We have a big 90-minute show coming your way to kick off the week on Monday. It's a very Halloween theme for you. We're going to start it with scary TV and movie expert Christine Madrid French. Her latest book is The Architecture of Suspense. It's a wonderful tribute to Alfred Hitchcock. And we'll talk about her wonderful scary TV moments and what she's looking forward to on the horror TV scene this month, post-Halloween 2. That's our lead guest. Then, From the Mole, which started a new run on Netflix earlier today, executive producer Chris Colbinor. We'll also talk to Chris about a brand-new project he's working with the creators of Deal or No Deal. It's called The Floor. It may be the biggest brainiac show to come hit television in a long time, where the big winner, if they can get past 99 other people with as much as 99 other topics, all kinds of questions, all sorts of categories, could win $1 million. And if you think you've seen every horror movie in sight around October time. Wait till you see the new Hulu movie, Grim Cuddy. The writer-director, John William Rose, will be with us. It's the first where, as far as I know, the monster lies in your computer and beyond. That's all coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, here on Swarby Televised. And then 1 week from today, among our guests, the creator executive producer of the new CW series out of Canada, Family Law, Susan Nielsen. If you came in late on today's episode and you want to catch up on episodes you missed this weekend, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. And remember, anytime you want, later today, this weekend, starting in a few minutes, you can hear this episode and other recent episodes on podcasts. Lots of great websites to check it out on, podcast platforms, whether it is our own website, tomorrowbetelevisedonpodium.com, Google Podcasts, podcast.google.com, podvine.com, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, the iRadio Podcast Network, Spotify, Acast, and other great sites. And if there's a podcast site you like that doesn't take our show, let them know that you would like to have them take it. Let me know, and we'll talk to them, and we'll make something happen. We always love hearing from you, so check us out. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's how you get involved in our classic trivia contest. If you have an idea for a show to know, well, let us know by email. If we use your suggestion on the air, you get the credit. Also, if you go to our onpodium.com site, use the question box. If we answer a question that you put in the box on the air, dealing with television, your truly thoughts about the medium, et cetera, you get the credit as well. And remember, you can also communicate with me anytime you like on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. It's Facebook and LinkedIn, Simon Applebaum, and Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. We always love to hear what you have to say, and we do respond within 24 hours, as I promised to you. Why? Because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed are those of the participants. They are not, say, those of Blog Talk Radio and other streamers of this program. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager. Jay Sonnenberg is head of content. Website service provided by On Podium, the Internet's new and big podcast outpost. Guitarist Vakas is our web coordinator. For Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a fantastic weekend ahead. Please keep thoughts and prayers coming to all the people dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. If you'd like to make a contribution, do so at redcross.org or go to the Florida Relief Fund at their website. Whatever you can contribute, it is deeply appreciated, and promise you, the people in Florida, they are gung-ho about getting their cities back, and they will, thanks in part to you. We'll be back on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. You know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and TuneIn Radio, and all of our podcast platforms. Until you then, whatever you're up to now and then, please make it safe and great. Again, if you haven't been vaccinated, see your doctor, check your medical situation. Remember, there's a lot of alternatives now available to you. You don't have to take boosters and shots if you don't want to. So check things out and then make a great choice, your choice, and stick with it. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.